It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds. The popular narrative around public schools is that they're failing, that teachers and administrators are to blame. Reformers argue for charter schools. They call for evaluating teachers based on the test scores of their students. They urge abolition of policies that reward seniority among teachers. Diane Ravitch thinks they're wrong. She thinks what passes for reform is a hoax. Ravitch is a historian of education, a research professor at New York University. She was Assistant Secretary of Education in the first Bush administration, and her latest book is called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to American Schools. Great to have you back. Thanks for coming by.
Wonderful. Thank you for inviting me.
You write that contrary to public opinion, public education is not broken, nor is it, quote, failing or declining, end quote. And of course, one reason people say that is that they look at the graduation rate from schools. And according to one report I saw from earlier this year, 78.2%, which suggests that one in five students don't graduate from high school. Is that true?
Well, there's two ways to look at graduation rates. One is to look at just the four-year rate, the kids who graduate in exactly 4 years. The 78% number is the highest that it's been in ever in our history. But if you look at the number of young people between the ages of 18 and 24 who have a high school diploma, it's 90%. So you can look at those either way. And whether you're looking at the 78% or the 90%, both of them represent the highest mark in our history for the graduation rate. So it's not falling, it's not declining, it's rising, and it's historically high.
Well, that's one example of where you see schools doing the right thing. What are some of the other signs you see that public education is healthy?
Well, another thing to look at, and we hear this all the time from people like Bill Gates and Michelle Rhee, that the scores have been flat for X number of years, and that's totally not true. What I did in the book was to go back and look at the U.S. Department of Education website. There are 40 years of testing based on federal tests that have no stakes for anybody. And the test scores have gone up and up and up. They're today at a historic high for black students, white students, Hispanic students, and Asian students. Also, the dropout rates are the lowest that they've ever been in history for all four groups. So all of the indicators are excellent. The performance is at its highest point in history. There are places where academic performance, test scores is very low. And those places are where you find a combination of very high poverty and racial segregation. That's what I call a toxic combination.
And here's another reason that people say our schools are failing. They take a look at those scores, test scores, comparing American students to students in other countries, and they say, look, we're way down here, and so many countries are ahead of us. We must be failing in public education.
Well, that's ridiculous. You know, there was a report in 1983 called The Nation at Risk, and it said exactly the same thing. It said, we're number this, and Japan is much higher than us, where they're going to take over the world, and we're losing. And they compared us to other nations, and in the meanwhile, over the past 30 years, our economy has grown and grown. We're still the dominant military power in the world, still the dominant economic power in the world. But I would go back even farther to 1964, when the first international test was given. And there were 12 nations that took that test, and we came in 12 out of 12 in one grade and 11th out of 12 in the other grade. And one of the scholars that I quote in the book look to see, well, what's happened over the past 50 years? We have surpassed all the other 11 nations because test scores do not predict future economic performance. It's very clear just looking at the record. Now, as it happens, the latest international test, which is called the TIMSS, the scores came out just a few months ago. I think it was in December of 2012, and our kids did incredibly well. We actually were tied with Finland in mathematics in fourth grade and in eighth grade. Black students in Massachusetts tied their Finnish peers. But somehow the newspapers were so stuck with this narrative of failure that they couldn't see that we had actually made dramatic improvement.
What's your theory on why that is? Because this is not the narrative we hear about public schools. We hear public schools are in trouble, they're failing, they need to have change. Why do you think that is the kind of the prevailing conventional wisdom sometimes?
Well, I think it's the narrative began in 1983 with the Reagan-era report, A Nation at Risk. Our schools are failing. And then it began to be picked up, particularly by people on the far right who didn't like public education to begin with. And so they kept repeating over and over again, our schools are failing. And then every time there would be any new test score report, they'd say, aha, more failure. And no one was looking at the longitudinal trends. The longitudinal trends are all up. Now, the argument in my book is that the test—
Could you explain longitudinal trends for people who don't know what you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that if you look at the test scores from like 1971 to 2012, what you see is a steady and sometimes a dramatic improvement. Dramatic improvement particularly for black kids, Hispanic kids. The biggest gains, the biggest narrowing of the achievement gap between kids of different racial groups occurred in the late 70s and early 1980s. But we have seen this dramatic improvement, especially in mathematics, but also in reading, significant improvement. But that's not what you hear. My argument in the book is that the failure narrative is being cynically used by people on the far right, and in some cases, people who are duped by the far right, into saying, well, we need to try anything. We need to privatize our schools. The private sector can do it better.
And I want to get to that because that's something that's happening here in Washington State. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Diane Ravitch, a fierce defender of public schools and a fierce critic of those who would put in reform. She probably put that in quotation marks. Her new book is called Reign of Error. Just one of the things that people come up with for improving public schools, they say public schools can't do it. You have to have some charter schools that can operate outside of the administrative and union rules of public schools. And in Washington State last year, we became the 42nd state to approve charter schools, 40 schools over a few years. The first eight are expected to open next spring. And I spoke to Steve Sundquist. He's head of the Charter School Commission and asked him what he hoped would happen within a year. He said he hoped there would be better schools available for underprivileged youth, for some of those students you're talking about who have had a hard time. So I asked him, how are you going to measure that?
We certainly expect to see test scores up, and I think there will be other non-quantitative measures of that, perhaps attachment to education as a positive thing, not necessarily a quantitative thing.
And Sundquist said, you know, we're 42nd, so we've learned from the other schools. We'll see test scores up and we'll see qualitative improvements. Should we expect those from low-income students in charter schools in Washington State?
Well, if Washington State does what some other states have done, it will open charter schools that do not take a fair share of students with disabilities, who do not take a fair share of children who are English language learners. By fair share, I mean the same share, the same share is the neighborhood public school. And because it will leave out many of the kids who typically have lower scores and also have the ability to kick out kids who have lower scores. If it does that, yes, it will get higher scores. But what that does to the regular public school system is that it skims off the highest performing kids. And the amazing thing after now 20 years of charters in different places is that the overwhelming majority of studies of charters say that on average they do not get better results. And yet we know that they're skimming. We know that they're cherry-picking students. We know there's even been a federal report from the GAO, which is a very nonpartisan organization, saying that charters are not taking a fair share of kids with disabilities. And then when they do take kids with disabilities, they're taking the kids with the very mildest disabilities and leaving the hard cases for the public schools.
Diane Ravitch, one of the chapters in your new book takes a look at tenure and seniority among public school teachers. A couple of years ago, there was a failed effort here to pass a law that said if a school district has to do layoffs, it shouldn't do it just based on how long a teacher had been at the school. The idea there being that just because a teacher had been on the job for a long time didn't mean that they were the best teacher, and they wanted to have some consideration for maybe teachers who hadn't been on the job so long. Maybe they were better teachers. Why do you think tenure and seniority are so important for teachers?
Well, I actually have a somewhat nuanced view on that. I'm not a great fan of seniority I know that there are some systems where if you have one day longer or 1 week longer on the job, therefore you have preference over somebody who came in a little while later than you did. And I don't see the logic of that. I think that there are all kinds of exceptions. If a school needs a science teacher or a math teacher or a special education teacher, seniority shouldn't count. But I think that tenure is very important. And because tenure in K-12 education, unlike higher education, does not mean a lifetime job protection. It means you have, once your principal has said that you're doing a good job and you're a good teacher, it means that you have the right to due process when they want to fire you. You have the right to know what the evidence is and to have a hearing before an independent arbitrator. I think that that's reasonable. The reason I think it's so important is that if tenure ends, you will see large sections of the United States where the word evolution will never again appear. Tenure is essential for academic freedom. And people will be fired if they teach about evolution. They'll be fired if they teach about global warming. They'll be fired in certain states if they teach Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man or books by John Steinbeck or books by any number of authors who might be controversial in that community. So I do think that tenure is a guarantee of academic freedom for teachers.
You were telling me just before we went on that Bill Gates has called you one of his primary opponents in this education issue. And, of course, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation advocates for education reform that you're not particularly in favor of. Has the Gates Foundation advanced the cause of improving public education?
Well, there was an article in Newsweek a couple of years ago where he told a journalist that I was his chief adversary. And I got a good laugh out of that because, of course, he has many billions of dollars and I just have my words. I speak, I write, that's all I've got. And I found it exhilarating to think that I might be his chief adversary. It shows the power of words. I've disagreed with him to begin with when he went into the idea that all large schools had to be broken up. I think some did, some didn't. But he took a sledgehammer approach and then in 2008 decided that didn't work. But $2 billion later, that didn't work. And now he has this fixed idea that teacher evaluation is broken and that if we evaluate teachers in large part based on the test scores of their students, then we'll find out who the really good teachers are and fire the bad teachers. That has turned out to be a disaster. It hasn't worked anywhere it's been tried. He's poured hundreds of millions of dollars into it. And Arne Duncan, our Secretary of Education, has poured billions of dollars into it, and it's not working anywhere.
We have just scratched the surface of Diane Ravitch's new book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to American Schools, a provocative read if you want to find out more perspectives on public education. Great pleasure to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Russ.
This is The Record on KUOW.